Welcome to the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast. August 17, 2025, episode 280, Lazy Hazy. Hello, everyone. Welcome into the corner, the Beekeeper's Corner. I'm Kevin England. Episode 280, making our way to 300. Well, lately it's just been that, a lazy, hazy, crazy days of summer. Fresh off a weekend of racing last weekend at Watkins Glen Road Course, and I'm back home again. It's been hot and humid this week. It's not a lot of fun working bees in do-rag conditions. Do you do that? I always have a bandana around my head because the sweat rolls down through my eyes. Make sure you take a lot of breaks and keep yourself well hydrated. This is the time of year in beekeeping where beekeepers are either super busy or chilling out, and I guess it's all according to the plans you've made and what you have going on. For us, we're in a bit of a coast period. No manipulations going on, per se. All of that was taken care of with a little push of activity just before heading to New York State. Primarily, the job at hand right now is wrapping up treatments, making sure colonies are queen right, we're all good there, and especially this season, feeding. Yesterday, August 16th, marked National Honeybee Day. And here's to hoping that you had a good day and maybe did an outreach event to promote beekeeping. Oh, I was just reflecting on Watkins Glen. We got a chance to go to the Honeybee Embassy, a nice little farm store in New York, placed in an idyllic setting. The building is a centerpiece. Beautiful arrangement with honeys from around the world, different balms, scrubs, and such. We were tipped off to its existence by the owner of the rental we were staying in and stopped to take a visit. You know, there they offered honey-flavored sodas made on demand. And well, I'm really not doing it justice, so go visit this website, brightravenfarm.com, brightravenfarm.com. Click on the link on the menu across the top. To see the Honeybee Embassy, you'll see an excellent example of how to showcase honey and products of the hive and do outreach events. And I'm sure they were buzzing yesterday. Dang, I'm in the intro and I did a sidebar already. Let's say I get on track and tell you what's in this episode. Roundtable number one, heat of nectar. Some like it hot. Roundtable number two, the other beekeeper corner. As you hear, I'm not sure what to make of this. Roundtable number three, I mentioned National Honeybee Day just a moment ago. Roundtable number three is just a touch of background on its origin. Roundtable number four, smoky smoke, but not from smoke. You'll know when I get there. Roundtable five, flexibility, taking a moment to reflect on the shape of honeycomb as it's prepared by the bees. Roundtable number six, a paleo, dairy-free dessert made with avocado, chocolate, and honey. And on top of that, there's a featured topic on replacement queens and a local hive report. I have to say, what's not to love? Kevin at BK Corner is my email. Show notes are on the website. BK Corner, episode 280. Let's go. Roundtable number one, some like it hot. When it comes to your drink of choice, I know the weather often has an influence on what we might choose. In the heat of summer, perhaps you might choose an iced mocha frappalapa drink if you're standing in the Starbucks line. For me personally, I'm usually not the type. I would go for a nice cold lemon iced tea over a cloyingly sweet coffee drink. Or Jennifer Coolidge's double shot, double froth, double pump, double whip, double hot, double sleeve coffee. But when it comes to coffee, it could be 95 degrees with 99% humidity and you'll see me drinking my 3 o'clock coffee piping hot. And that's just how I like it. Well, in a kind of sort of way, pollinators are that way too. It seems that if honeybees had their choice, they would take in nectar that is warm, much more so than nectar that they'd find on a plant that's on the cool side. Researchers say that this is even more true for bumblebees. It appears there's more to it for bumblebees than avoiding the chill. In research situations, they found that bumblebees actually use the warmth of the liquids they ingest as part of keeping their bodies warm and operational. In Tom Seeley's book, The Life of Bees, he has a few chapters on how important it is for honeybees to get their bodies to a specific temperature before they operate. In fact, he spends quite a bit of time advocating for moving bees up higher in space so that when they fly off in chilly weather, they don't end up on the ground, especially in snow. As if they would be rapidly chilled, it would cause detriment and even they would die. As I mentioned in episode 273, bees seem to have found a bounty of multiflora rose earlier this season. And one thing I noted when I was watching that is that the bees didn't seem to be on the flowers in abundance in the afternoon. To say that differently takes a moment of observation. To my eyes, it looked like when the sun comes up, the plant wakes up and it offers its nectar. It's true that some plants offer nectar at certain parts of the day. In fact, at the EAS conference, I heard someone say that plants are done offering nectar by 2 p.m. I don't know that I actually believe that. I think there's so much diversity out there that things change from that perspective. But I do seem to recall from personal observation that honeybees are more apt to be on plants from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. and not so much from 2 p.m. to 6 p.m. I cannot say if that has to do with the warmth of the day or it's some other idiosyncrasies of the plants, but there might be something to the plant reacting to the first warmth of the sun in the early morning, as sunny spots were, of course, more popular with bees than plants in shady cover. So if you're one of those that is only about a steaming cup of joe, know that you're not alone. It's not only the scent of the flowers and their shape and readiness that attracts insects for pollination, it could also be the warmth of their nectar that has a little something to do with what plants are buzzing and the timing windows where the pollinators like to visit. Roundtable number 2, Beekeeper Corner. For this roundtable, I'm going to mention something that is not the beekeeper's corner, but it's the beekeeper corner. Recently, I've encountered a few collisions with another website using a similar name, namely the Beekeeper Corner. It's a beekeeping blog out of Vermont, and to be honest, I'm not sure how I feel about it. I know that names are names, and when two similar names of content repositories appear in the same line of interest, namely beekeeping, it can sometimes cause consternation. This blog, Beekeeper Corner, which seems to have a lot of content, leads me to believe that it's been out there for some time, yet it suddenly appeared on my radar, and now it keeps showing up as I interact doing research. I finally took a moment to browse the offering, after trying to ignore this, and I went there to get familiar with the information being posted. It somewhat reminds me of the Beekeeper Charlotte blog in that it has a lot of content about a lot of things. And what I find is good, bad, and indifferent. I suspect that the content creator of that body of work, if they looked at my stuff, they would probably say the same thing about what I present. It's good, bad, and indifferent. And to that I say, to each their own. I see some red flags, though, and I would really like to know that there's an honest beekeeper behind the effort. The disconcerting thing about what I see there is the dates of the posted content. I have to say, out loud, appearances seem out of place. And what stands out is, as of this year, at some point, there are extensive blog posts, and they're put up on a daily basis. And in some instances, there's several of these blog posts going out on the same day. To understand why that's kind of weird, each post follows a model and pattern that has multiple sections and subsections and includes a table of contents. And if I were to venture how long it would take me, an EAS Master Beekeeper, to write one of those articles, well, let's just say I wouldn't be cranking out one a day, not to mention multiple. In one section, I think I saw 7 articles released on the same day. At least the post date had that. Now, maybe, giving the benefit of the doubt, they were written over a long period and someone is migrating a catalog of blogs into the body of work. And as they post them day after day, moving them in, that could explain the date, why they're so close together. It's a hard thing to know. But nowadays, and my spidey sense is tingling, websites are popping up like this as resources with ulterior motives. Adam Hickman referenced this in a recent discussion we had at the EAS conference when he said that he physically writes every piece on his website and countered that no AI was used to generate the article. In today's influencer world, clicks are clicks, visits are visits, and these drive statistic engines. And this is all the better when you have a network of affiliate links that generate revenue if someone reads a post and passes through, producing a little coin in the process. And if you go read the site information, it does indicate that there are affiliate links. I, being the curious person I am, wrote to the website using the contact email, and it bounced back saying the email is invalid. The About Me page of the website says the creator is James Anderson, a Vermont beekeeper. I Googled that name, and I can't find a single reference to a beekeeper in Vermont doing any educational work. Now, it seems to me that creators writing content like this usually don't operate in a vacuum, under the radar. So, it's a little weird. Case in point, I happened to get to chat last week at EAS with David Burns. He's everywhere. David Burns, if you don't know, is a YouTuber, EAS Master Beekeeper, and a great educator, and is constantly producing content to help beekeepers. And he's out there, as an influencer is. It just so happens, and this is a Kevin moment, I joked with David that I was talking with my boss, and my boss said, you know, I read this article, and I really like this guy, and whatever, and it was David Burns. I passed that along to him when I was chatting with him at EAS. I thought that was funny, and a Kevin moment. Now, Mr. James is doing all of this work, and it says in his bio that he has a marketing background, but there are no social media links in his solution, and he doesn't exist on the web. I'm bad at marketing sometimes, but this just seems off. One article I clicked on goes on and on about voles. You know, voles, the things that burrow in the ground. They're kind of like a mouse, but different. It indicates that they're a pest of honeybee colonies. What? We have many, many, many voles on our property. It's one of the unique things that we discovered, I discovered, never saw them where I grew up, but they were here on the property when we bought it. Never, not once, have I ever seen an interaction with the voles that dig in the ground here with our honeybee colonies. And honestly, I'm not buying it, but giving the benefit of the doubt, perhaps it's a Vermont thing. For giggles, I went to Microsoft Copilot AI and asked it, and this was an honest question because I just wanted to know if I was off the mark, are voles harmful to honeybees? It emphatically said yes and cited all kinds of familiar passages. When I asked it the source, well, you guessed it, it's a Vermont blog by the Beekeeper Corner. When I told the AI it was hallucinating, it actually came back and admitted it was right. that that was the only source. And it also went on to say that time and time again, other notable documenters of pests of the honeybee colony have never listed voles as a pest of honeybee hives. There's no mention. I think when you kind of look at this in the big picture, you can understand where the concerns are coming from. I want to hope that this James person is real. And if so, well, so be it. That's okay. He's entitled to write whatever he wants and how he writes it. And hopefully that if the content is good, bad, or indifferent, people will take it for what it's worth. But, you know, this could also be a website out of who knows where, emulating the name of my podcast and building content for misdirection. In this day of AI-written websites, all things are possible. So, I guess I have to go further and ask. Inquiring minds want to know, do I have any listeners from Vermont that can verify that the creator of this website, James Anderson, out of Vermont, with hives in three different locations, is a true person? And if so, could you write me a kevin@bkcorner.org to let me know? I would love to make acquaintance with Mr. Anderson and just have a discussion. What I actually wrote in the email that I sent was, it seems that we're both trading under a similar name and we might want to put some sort of disclaimer on our site saying we're not the other one. That was the honest to God thing that I wrote. But when the email bounced back, that was before I started really digging into the website, it made my spidey sense tingle. Kevin@bkcorner.org if anyone knows who James Anderson is from Vermont. Thanks. Roundtable number 3, National Honeybee Day. A quick heads up, National Honeybee Day is Saturday, August 16th this year, 2025. National Honeybee Day takes place every third Saturday of August in the United States. You know, we have to give thanks to the group in 2009 who petitioned for the proclamation. As the story goes, the idea for National Honeybee Day was proposed by Sue Coby, the Queen Lady, to the USDA, and in 2009, the NHBD was officially declared. I'm going to take a moment to do a combo platter first to all the association leaders and members, and simply the beekeepers, a sincere thank you for all that you do. Sometimes the work is a slog, but most times the reward of being a beekeeper is unlike anything one can enjoy as a hobby or occupation. The second part of this is an encouragement for you to look around. Given it's a Saturday in the summer, it's not uncommon for beekeepers to take advantage of outreach events to mark the day. And it might be possible that there'll be something you stumble upon if you keep your eyes peeled. Roundtable number 4, I call this one Smoke That. I'd like to think that I'm the adventurous type, but sometimes you look at something and you think, no. Case in point, I was wandering around the EAS trade show and saw the booth for the smokeless smoker. I looked over at that booth and thought, that's novel and interesting, but I have an old school curmudgeon notion that I didn't even know that I have ever been disappointed about how a smoker works. So I strolled by, watching the video that was playing in the booth and observing the sales pitch that was going on while keeping my distance. Yet, as I walked away, I had a moment of remorse at not looking at it. And I'm sorry, I still didn't do it before I left. I just wasn't in the mood for a sales pitch. Now, as I sit here reflecting, I have to say that EAS was a bit overwhelming this year. And I didn't have a notion to dig in like years past. And also, I knew what I was going to buy and didn't want to talk to someone about something that I knew I couldn't purchase because I was going to buy the things I was going to buy and be happy with that. You know, the other thing was, there was so much going on and Bob Kloss wasn't there. And usually he and I chat about the things we see that are a little off the beaten path. Didn't have my sounding board. Whatever the case, it popped up in my reflections, and even now, I don't think it's something I would consider. But just because I really don't have a desire to get away from something that works for me, it doesn't mean that I might not be interested in looking into the background of the tool for the purpose of knowing its utility. Sometimes I approach things this way and find out that, well, maybe there's a need for this after all. And it compels me to look at things that I don't personally find interesting. So smokeless smokers, it seems they spray something akin to an aerosol or a fog that has additives. When vaporized, emulate the smoke particles that the bees react to. I recall from talking with veteran beekeepers that this was done before. There used to be something way back, and I've seen it in the old catalogs. It's not on the market anymore. There was some sort of aerosolized spray that you would use, like a spray can, like hairspray. Now, I do think the aspect of smoke in the hive, especially for honey, is something of interest. I teach, smoking a hive is of no concern to the operation of the colony, and of course it's been done since the invention of the smoker, but when it comes to smoking honey supers, I teach to forego that process. When pulling honey, I will smoke the entrance at the bottom of the hive and give a puff over the inner cover. But when it comes to harvesting, I forego smoking down into the box. Because you know what? Any of that residual smoke could get picked up from any of the ripened nectar that's not fully capped. And I'm really not going for a smoky goodness in my honey. Now I could go off on a tangent here about smoked honey. It's not too shabby actually. But I have a Kevin moment to share instead. The other day I was driving to Valley Crest after working bees in my home yard. I had the smoker sitting in an ammunition box set on the floor of the passenger compartment next to me. The smoker was sitting idle before I left. And my assumption is I would have to relight it when I got to Valley Crest. As I was driving along, I was on the phone with someone and noticed the smoker started to smoke. It was in a place where I couldn't stop. I was in heavy traffic on a highway. And at some point, the smoke wafting out of the smoker was full-blown. And the entire passenger side of my car was loaded with smoke, and I was, like, choking on the phone. I pulled over at a stop sign, put the car in park, hustled out over to the curb, grabbed a clump of weed grass growing between the sieves of the pavement of the road and the curbing, and I quick fastened a bundle of it and stuffed it in the nozzle of the smoker to suffocate the oxygen that lets the smoker continue to operate. And when I got to Valley Crest, I pulled the plug of grass out, gave a few puffs on the smoker, and you know what? Came back to life, which was kind of interesting. A few days later, I drove my car and parked it at my brother's as he drove us to Watkins Glen for the NASCAR race. When we got home from the NASCAR weekend, I opened the door of my car and it smells completely of smoke. And well, I have to wonder how long that smell is going to be there. And this is the interesting bit. It is this experience that compels me, because it's not the first time, not to use smoke on my honey supers. That lingering smoke essence is going to stay in my car for a long time, and it will stay in your honey. End of Kevin moment. Now, coming back to center, this single instance is an interesting fit for the smokeless smoker. It would only produce smoke when you push the button, and it would never do this inside your car. I can think of another reason. Smokers sometimes set the world on fire. There's been brush fires and other things that have been done when someone set their smoker down and set the field afire. I could say I've done that once or twice, but you know, that's not something I couldn't stamp out, little spot fire. Isn't that interesting? Now, the chemistry of a beehive, unlocking the ability to get the same reaction from the bees as smoke without using smoke, that's an interesting study. If I remember correctly, the demise of the aerosol cans, the ones that were in the catalogs back in, what, I would say the 70s or 80s, I could be wrong about the time placement of that, was more a factor of the marketplace didn't adopt them, but there are also apparently health and environment concerns. Something about the formulations were suspect back then, that's speculation on my part, but they were spraying some essence of tar or something. And I would bet in California of today, they would not be allowed to market that. But it probably stands to reason that the new devices are going another route. They seem to use a vapor akin to the special effects you might see at a rock concert. Some atomized, maybe glycol-based product that creates a smoky effect. And it's seeded with an ingredient, likely some form of essential oil that emulates smoke to the bees. It is kind of a vapor form of liquid smoke when you think about it from a descriptor, but it's not liquid smoke. Those products that are used for the cooking industry, they're made by condensed water that's been extracted out of smoke vapors. And all of what I shared just has me talking out loud. I'm not an expert on the science of this. I'm simply sharing my impressions how I think this stuff would work looking at it from across the hall in the EAS booth. But I've had incidental encounters with this type of activity. There was a time when I looked into smoked honey and dug in on the science, and my recollections are from that background. Who knows? It could be 180% off base. It's hard to tell. So maybe my vision will change over time. I do know that breathing in the smoke from the pine needles of our smokers, not good for us. And that perhaps somewhere down the road, the industry would shift and go to this thing if it's going to work. I do have to say that the form factor of it, it was a pistol grip like a drill. Smart. The design was smart. It was yellow and black, beekeeping colors. But call me old school, I'm not ready to give up the tradition. But that doesn't mean I won't watch from afar. Smokeless smokers. Have one? Tried it? Look in the catalogs. I bet you're going to see more of them show up as time goes by. Roundtable number 5, call this one flexibility. I saw an interesting photo the other day on the interwebs that pointed out the intricacies of how honeybees build honeycomb when allowed to build it free form. Now, if you've ever taken a moment to watch how bees build comb naturally, you would note that the structures of the honeycomb is quite diverse. We beekeepers, steeped in using foundation, often see honeycomb in perfect grids with cells lined up next to each other in great precision. If, however, in your lifetime you switch to different types of hives, say top bars, lay-ins, Waré hive styles, or you use foundationless frames, you will come to know that naturally the bees do things quite differently. Now you might have come across this by accident, because what beekeeper hasn't left a frame out of the box and had some situation where the bees got a foothold of building errant comb down from the roof or the inner cover? But what I'm going to describe is something that you will see many times, but not all the time. When bees build wax structures off of a top bar on their own, they might build a bunch of glove-shaped sections next to each other. You could pick up a top bar frame that has no sides and see two, maybe three separate structures hanging down. Or sometimes they build one contiguous structure from one end to the other. It's kind of interesting, and I think that has to do with the mix of the number of bees that are wax building age and the resources coming in and all of that. Suffice it to say, it varies every single time. Whatever the situation, and coming back to the photo, when they build the interdependent ones, the little gloves, they eventually have to join them together. And when they join them together, it's the intersections that make the interesting observation. As they do so, they become quite creative. What you find in the end result is more like a wave pattern to the comb structure. Some cells are three-sided, four-sided, oblong, stretched. It's whatever they need to do to finish the job. And what I find is some bees are quite good at somehow matching the precision of the cells, and others are quite bad. And you never know on each individual frame how it's going to turn out. In my Lands hive, I have both foundation sheet frames and frames that are built foundationless in the same box. The difference is quite unique when you look at one frame situated next to the other. You often find that they will build open, wider cells through the top and worker comb through the middle, and the bottom of the frame, when left to their own devices, can also be large drone comb. The open cells store honey, the middle cells become the brood comb, and the bottom is used for drones at one point of the year and then storage in the other half. The honeycomb zones undulate as they transition from one to another, and there is little structure uniformity like what we see in regular honeycomb produced on the sheet foundation. This observation leads me to wonder if there's any advantage to one versus the other. In the guise of the old adage that when the wind blows a feather here, that translates to a weather event over there, I wonder if the comb, the way that it's built, has any impact on colony dynamics. So let's think about that critically and suggest some differences that might occur. Now, the first thing that comes to mind for me is how it might impact how the bees hang out on a comb. Where the bees reside and what they do is likely different from one to another frame based on the type of honeycomb structures they're working on. I could describe it in this way. The honey sections, the brood sections, and the worker and drone all hold bees that do those jobs. It's like the difference in your house when you make food in your kitchen, you eat food in your dining room. There's a purpose and a space and a place for what takes place there. Translate that to another pivot. Think about it from thermodynamics. Where the bees join, there's heat. What about the heat differences from the bees hanging out? Given the changes in workforce gathering over the year for what they're doing and how they overwinter and all of these things, I could imagine that the heat retained by both the bodies of the bees and the substrates in the comb have to be a pinch different. Now, mind you, I know that these are on a micro scale, but when you take them in aggregate and considering frame after frame after frame in a box, I can't help but think that there's something truly different in the two situations, whether you give them foundation that has such structure to it or you let them build their own. Now, in a Kevin moment, I know, you look inside of a beehive and no two beehives look alike. No two colonies are the same. They're all like little children. They're all different. Is this really relevant? Probably not, but it's just an interesting aside to think about. End of Kevin moment. As I think through it, there's one more thing, one more consideration. It's the undulation that I remarked about. What impact does having one thing situated next to another thing in a rather organic fashion have on how the bees get the job done? To store their food and care for their brood in development. Is it more harmonious in the organic fashion, or does it work in some measure that it's better on the structured footprint of a printed foundation sheet? As I alluded, in the end, I can't even say if this matters, but when looking at honeycomb in the natural setting, it's quite a bit different from our manufactured workplace that we created for them. And I always wondered if we made it better for them or we put them at a disadvantage. Roundtable number 6, Moosey. Today happens to be Mexican Day at our house. I told Sharon recently that I just had a hankering for Mexican food. And I've been trying to cook a little bit out of one of the cookbooks we own, the Rick Martinez Mi Cocina Recipes in Rapture from my kitchen in Mexico. I don't know if you've come across this, but everything that we've made out of it so far has just been spectacular. Never really tried to cook Mexican at home, but this is just amazing. That being said, one of the things that I had on the to-do pile came from the honey recipe where I mixed chocolate in honey and gave it a pinch of cayenne in the Mexican style. After that episode, Jovette Thingman, one of our listeners, sent me a Mexican chocolate avocado mousse recipe. And when I have to check the box on a recipe, one of the things that I want for dessert is something that is honey-based. And this one is both chocolate and honey, so what's not to love? So this afternoon, when we saddle up to the dinner table, we're going to have Mexican chocolate avocado mousse. The recipe comes from cookeatpaleo.com. Look for Mexican chocolate avocado mousse recipe there. This serves six. And this is dairy-free, for those who are interested in that. This is what's in it. Two large ripe avocados, a half cup of cacao powder, half cup of full-fat coconut milk, a third cup of raw honey. You could use maple syrup, but of course, we beekeepers, we're going to use honey. 2 teaspoons of vanilla extract, 1 teaspoon of cinnamon, or to taste, a little less, a little more, and 1/4 teaspoon of ground ancho chili powder. Now, if you don't want the spiciness in it, you can leave it out. But whenever you listen to chefy-type people, they'll always tell you that a little bit of chili powder wakes up your taste buds and makes you taste the chocolate more. If you don't want to use 1/4 teaspoon, try a little bit less. Just put a pinch in, a little touch. To make it couldn't be easier, you combine all these ingredients in a food processor and just process it until it's smooth and comes together. Spoon it out into your serving dishes and stash it in the fridge for a little while till it's cold. So I'll be making it this afternoon, and I'm positive that it's going to be amazing. I know somewhere along the line I went to an Asian market, and when I was there I picked up coconut milk, full-fat coconut milk, to make curries, and so I happened to have some. It's a little bit of an odd thing. A lot of people don't keep that, but you can find it on the internet. It's not a hard product to source. And now is avocado season. They come perfect from the store right now. Mexican chocolate avocado mousse, we'll be having it later today. And thanks to Jo Beth for sending the recipe along. I've had this one sitting in the wait queue, and today's the day. Roundtable number 7, vaping. I got an email from someone recently saying, do you know if there's anybody that rents out or loans out oxalic acid vaporizers? And it got me to thinking, that's an interesting question. Beekeeping clubs often have extractors that get rotated around during the summer for people who need to harvest their honey. Extractors are pretty expensive, and so are oxalic acid vaporizers. Ask me how I know, I just bought one. Now, the interesting thing about vaporizing is that once you make the initial investment, the treatments are really inexpensive. And so the question lies, is there an opportunity for beekeeping clubs and or some other construct that could buy a couple of these and then rent them around, loan them around? Loan them is really what I'm leaning on. Now, I have to say, given my experience, that even something as inane as an extractor can go missing. Our club lost one. No idea who has it. Somebody borrowed it, held on to it, probably the last one for the season. And the following, somebody lost track of who had it. Nobody knows where it is. That's a really goofy thing to have happen. You would think that the person who rented it would turn around and go, hey, do you want your extractor back? But they didn't. And let's just leave it at that. That was many, 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 many years ago. And now, our club, when we rent the two extractors, not rent, loan, keep saying rent, we are scrupulous, lesson learned, about who has it, when they're going to have it, when they're going to give it back, and so on. Oxalic acid vaporizers could be loaned around, but one of the problems is people want to treat multiple times over a course every 5 days. So if you loan it to person X and their plan is to use it 4 times over 5 days, then they're going to have it for, let's say, a month. Does it make sense when someone else calls that they can't do it? And it's not like in the middle of those 5 days, somebody's going to run over and lend it to this person and then they're going to bring it back. That's a recipe for disaster. But again, just thinking out loud, not sure if anybody has a plan or a program for this. I'd be curious. Kevin@bkcorner.org. Is it something where you buy 3 or 4 of them? And I'm going to say something about beekeeping clubs. And this is just an out loud commentary. I've been to so many different meetings of beekeeping clubs, dozens of them. And almost any time that you're there to speak or you hear your own, you hear the treasurer's reports. And there is not many clubs that I know of that don't have enough money in their treasury to invest in a couple of these things and still be flush with enough funds to operate. So to buy, say, 3 or 4 of these would not be a significant burden, in my opinion. It's just me talking out loud based on experience and observation. So what do you think of this idea? Is this something that beekeeping clubs should consider? I'm not sure. But given the request that I had, well, it's just now a curiosity. Is this something that could be a service to beekeepers, given how normal and pervasive oxalic acid vaporization is? Again, if you have any ideas on this, kevin@bkcorner.org is my email. Write me in. Let me know what you think. Topic number one for this episode, replacing queens. As noted by the title, this is going to be about queen replacement. And on the whole, if you have any experience with this, it's usually you just put a queen in, they come and release her, and the queen takes over the colony. Sounds simple. But, you know, with some activities in beekeeping, to get the best success, the devil's in the details. And I think this is one where the devil can show up. And so you really do need to take a moment, take pause, and do the process right. So much so that I think the instruction requires 2 parts, and this is going to be part 1 of a 2-part feature. The first part about replacing queens is recognizing that you need a new queen, or the situations that get you into needing a new queen, and how to go about finding a replacement and getting it into your apiary. In part 2, I want to talk about how to actually install it. There's a couple different processes, and I want to kind of elaborate your options there. But the first thing is, why do you have a queen failure? Sometimes the queens just run out of gas. Other times you inadvertently kill or damage a queen. And maybe you're starting to see brood pattern problems, bullet drones and things like that. Queen is not laying fertilized eggs. And last but not least, maybe you decide to make a change for temperament. When bees are nasty, you should really just bite the bullet and replace the queen. And as summer is heading into fall, now is the time to ensure that you inspect all your colonies to make sure that they're queen right and in a good place. For as the summer progresses, it's harder to find quality queens to put in your box as replacements. And as you push further into fall, it will become even harder or impossible to source one. Now, one thing I want to say about one of those conditions is about brood patterns. Just a quick aside, sometimes brood patterns look off this time of year. Maybe it's not a queen problem. David Tarpey, the queen expert, sometimes says that we blame a lot of things on queens, and here I can agree with him. Let's take, for example, that what goes on this time of year, you have the highest varroa load as they've built out through the entire spring, and it's possible the underlying condition is varroa impacts have resulted in poor brood patterns. So before you get on the horse to replace your queen, consider what your varroa situation is. If you've not cleaned up your varroa, you should do that quick, fast, and in a hurry. And then if your queen problem persists, consider replacement. Now, a lot of times beekeepers don't put a lot of thought into this. They buy a queen from wherever they can get it, and they install it in the box, and it works. The good news for you is most times the queens that you purchase are mutts, and they're simpatico with whatever you put in. Other times, maybe you have a notion to buy a special queen or a specific line, and what I would caution you is to consider what you have in your equipment, and don't get too exotic so that you find some sort of compatibility problem. Now, it's near impossible to look into your box and say, I have this kind of bee. For almost all queens you buy these days are a mixed race. There are a little of this and a little of that. What typically happens is if they're yellow, they're Italian. If they have a other, tannish color, they could be Caucasian or someone who might call them Carniolian. And if you actually purchased a specific type of queen, a format, then maybe you actually know you have Carniolian bees. All of this to say in the extreme that if you know you're running Italians or Carniolians or something else, don't buy a Russian queen. It would be like trying to have a foreign head of state come in and run the solution. The bees are not going to accept that. Now is not the time to experiment with different races and see if you can get a Russian queen to take over your Italian hive. When it comes to sourcing your queens, maybe you just started this year and your queen didn't get mated well in the beginning, and it came from a package out of Florida or South Carolina, Georgia. Should you go back to your provider down there and buy a queen? It's an option, and a lot of them do sell queens. But I would argue that you'd be better off to turn to a local provider and go for local stock. It is proven that local queens are better to overwinter, produce better, make more honey, and generally the operation of the quality of the function of the colony is higher with locally adapted stock, meaning queens that know the conditions you're operating in. You're free to buy a queen from wherever. You can go into the beekeeping magazines and catalogs, go in the back and look at all the queen sellers and buy queens. But people in the know would tell you that a local queen would probably be a better option. Now, what I would say is, beyond compatibility, it's not a difficult thing to consider buying a queen that is of higher quality. These days, there's a lot of adverts out there for queens that have special capabilities, varroa-sensitive hygiene and such. If you can buy a high-quality genetics in your realm, yeah, you should. Not a bad idea. Always try to get the best quality queen that you can. Good stock. But at this time of year, beggars can't be choosers. And if you can get a local mutt that doesn't have a special label. Well, quite frankly, magic queens aren't that magical sometimes. And a good, fundamentally sound queen raised by a responsible queen rearer in your area is as good as you can get. I know there's a lot of controversy with that statement, but, you know, you do you. I'm just saying that don't turn your nose up at somebody who has a proven track record of supplying quality queens in your area, and they didn't get the marketing jingle of putting a special label on it. If you're buying from a supplier that ships, they'll often have you covered in shipping with a package that passes the test. They're in the business of shipping queens. Damaged queens don't work, so they usually have a pretty sound approach. They know how to securely ship a queen. Don't assume, though, that the queen's going to arrive in good order. The important aspect for you here is to do your best to work with the shipper if you can, whether it's a local post office or some other service like FedEx or such, UPS. You want to get the queen as soon as possible, and they're almost always shipped overnight, and it's worth paying to have them get there as fast as possible. Now, sometimes these things are out of your control, and other times you can make a connection with the shipper to let them know that the package contains live, fragile content and timeliness is of the essence. This is especially true if you're working with your local post office. I explain to them a little bit about what's going on and ask them to give you some special consideration. Now, on the flip side, there are other times, of course, that you might do a face-to-face handoff. And if you're going to meet someone to pick up a queen for transport, work it out with them ahead of time. I say plan the work, work the plan. Find out how they're going to give you the queen, and run past them the manner in which you plan to transport it. And the farther you are away from the person you're getting the queen from, the more time you should spend in understanding how to hold the queen in transport. Now, oftentimes the queen's going to be in a queen cage of some kind with a candy plug and a couple of attendants. The typical thing to do is fashion a transport device to carry them in. Bees are actually quite sturdy, but there's no reason why you can't coddle them, keep them comfortable, keep them protected. My man Bob Kloss, my friend, I think has worked out a really good solution that I think would suit anybody. He takes a small can cooler, the hard-sided one. He has a vessel inside which he's packed cotton or something soft, and he takes the queen cage and he sticks it inside. Then the rest of the container has soft contents in it, and he often takes a vessel, depending on the temperature, and puts some warm water in it to keep the temperature at a proper place. As to what a proper place is, I would venture a guess that anywhere between room temperature comfortable, 70-ish degrees, and below 95, nothing too hot, would do the job, would do the trick. If you're a little nervous about this, show your transport vessel to your queen provider. I promise you they've likely seen it all, and they can offer any last-minute guidance to get your queen home safely. Think of it like the grade school project where you built a container to keep the egg from breaking, if you ever did that in school. Another option, thinking out loud, is that you can look in a bee catalog. Sometimes they have devices that they sell that have been purposely made for this function. Now, once you get your queen home, one of the most important things is to install her as timely as possible. The quicker she gets laying, the higher the acceptance and the better it is for her. And another aspect of timing, the last thing to say to close out this part of the feature, is about recognizing the problem. Coming back to the beginning, this is the time of year where a lot of folks go on vacation. August is a great month in the United States. You've just harvested your honey and you need a break. You need to make sure that at minimum, as early as you can, you go through all of your colonies and make sure they're queen right and not experiencing queen problems. It's fairly customary for people to take vacations this time of year and come back in September and find a problem, and then you really have to scramble to find a queen replacement. Don't be one to discover late in the season that your queen's going south. You really could put your colony in jeopardy for two reasons. One, replacing a queen late in the season usually means some sort of interruption in the bees being produced for winter. And two, that leads to the possibility that the population just is not in the right place to overwinter and you're putting your colony at risk. So do yourself a favor and work in those late summer checkups to make sure the queen you have in your box, the one that's been producing wave after wave of bees all spring and summer, is not running out of gas or experiencing some sort of problem. I think this is where I'm going to stop. In part two of this feature, I'm going to come back to the physical process of placing your queen in the box. I'm going to give you a few ideas about how you might go about that. Time for this episode's local hive report. It's all good in the neighborhood. Right now, I'm in the process of doing what I said I was going to do, taking care of the hives for summer. I'll start with the playground apiary. There's six nuke boxes, six over six. Four of them are doing great. Two of them are a little sketchy. The two that are sketchy, they started out as three-frame nukes. They're probably up to maybe four and a half, five-frame nukes. But next to them, they have a single drawn comb, and below them, six combs of foundation. This is the experiment where I'm trying to feed through the remainder of the year to see if I can get them to build honeycomb, and thus far, these guys are not doing the job. Now contrast that to the other four. They've started to build new honeycomb on the new foundation wax frames, and while it's slow, it is beginning, and I don't anticipate that it will end once it gets started. And when these colonies can reach critical mass of population, you'd be surprised if they had the right nectar flow and or food going in, how well they'll do at building out, because nukes seem to have some sort of penchant, some of them, for building honeycomb. Now, because some of the hives, there were 10 originally, didn't make it through, the queens didn't pass muster, or whatever the case would be, and I did combines, the four that are doing well actually have some drawn comb, and so do the two that are not doing well, contributed from the hives that didn't make it through. So they're pretty much a mixed bag. One of the things I did in order to see if I could stimulate them to do a little better is, given they had five frames of brood, I took two frames and put them down in the bottom box. And since these are six-frame nukes, with the population up in the top box, first frame is a frame of bees, second frame is foundation, third, fourth are frames of bees, fifth is foundation, and sixth is bees. I put bees next to comb, undrawn, on both sides, in position two and position five of the six-frame box. I took the two frames that were built in the top and I put them in the center of the bottom box next to each other. In all cases, I found the queens. They all look great. What's funny is some of the patterns are a little haphazard, emerged spotty, which is typical this time of year when the food is inconsistent. But one of them, she's a shining star. She was filled every single cell from top the bottom frame left to right, both sides, for several frames. All in all, I'll give it a mixed bag. Some of them look good, some of them don't. But I think if I continue to stay on course, I can get these to overwinter, which is the number one goal. Now, turning to the main apiary, I did what I said I was going to do. I took two trips over the last couple of weeks, one to EAS, of course, and one to Watkins Glen for the NASCAR race. I did an inspection after getting home from Watkins Glen just to see how things are turning out. I've been feeding my Waray hive. I put a chicken feeder in there. They still only have one box. I wish I could get them to start building comb in the other boxes. They filled out the first box from side to side, but seem to have disdain for building any more comb. That's a work in progress, and yeah, the good old Waray. Things like a seed in my tooth. As to the rest of the main colonies in there, I'll start this by saying that I had a spare utility nucleus colony sitting up in front of the hives. It was a over six frame polystyrene hive, and it was packed with bees, and of course an operational queen. My goal, if you haven't been familiar with the journey I wanted to go on this summer, was to pull all capped brood out of my production colonies and consolidate it into one place. And I did just that. I went through six or seven colonies, pulled all the capped brood from them, and put them in 8-frame polystyrene boxes. It filled two of them. Given I pulled those frames out of the production colonies, something had to go back in. That's where that nuke that I just mentioned came in. I sourced the frames out of that nuke and put them into those 6 colonies in order to plug the holes. I was able to take the queen out of that nucleus colony and sequester her into a 5-frame nuke that I had on pad number 8. That colony that was there collapsed for some reason, not sure why, and had 2 frames of bees and a want for a queen. I gave them a queen and 2 frames of brood and stores, and now they're a 5-frame colony doing fine. So the queen from the new colony that no longer exists up front is now on pad number 8. Now, turning to the box of consolidated capped brood, it's 8 over 8, which is 16 frames. It was actually 15. I had to plug one in that was just capped, or just a drawn comb, of capped brood. And if you haven't been following, the reason I did this is this time of year, all the mites move in under the cappings, off of the drones, when there's no more drone combs and the drones are being ejected, and the concentration of varroa mites in all the colonies is under the capping. And so this colony, one of the questions I had was, as I pulled the frames, did I make an oops? It's possible, because all of those colonies were absolutely chock full of bees, that I could have pulled a queen. So when I did an inspection after coming back from Watkins, I noticed that there's queen cells in there. And my original plan was to take the nuke that I built on pad number 8 and combine it with this and give them a queen. It was going to be the queen from the sourced utility nuke colony up front. But now I'm having second thoughts. I think I'm going to leave that colony be on pad number 8. And given the fact that the queen cells that I saw in this colony, the consolidated one, looked really good, and there's still drones kicking around, I'm going to let it run. I still have an option to go put a queen in that somewhere, but as the season goes on, it's harder and harder to find a queen. But I think I'm going to let them try to rear a queen. And if worse comes to worse, and they epically fail, I could combine them with that utility nuke sitting on pad number 8. So what am I doing with this? I am going to let it sit. And it's getting a little late in the season, probably the end of August by the time I do something with it. But I have Formic Pro, and when all the bees emerge, I'm going to treat it with Formic Pro. Now I could treat it with Formic Pro right now. Formic Pro should penetrate the cappings. But I really want to get a good kill on this, so I'm going to let it go for a little bit and let the brood emerge and open up and let all the mites come out and be on the bees and wandering around in the wild. I figure, what's the harm in another week or two after all of this? I know that they'll be on the worker bees and maybe injuring them, and they're going to feed my future, population. So I'm not going to let it linger too long. As to the colonies where I pulled all of the brood, I did something that I absolutely had no plan to do, but necessity is the mother of invention. I treated them with Formic Pro. I was going to let them go for the year, kind of like treatment free, and give them a shot of oxalic acid a little later in the season when the brood started to taper down. But as it turns out, going through the inventory of products that I had, someone gave me Formic Pro. Actually, two people gave me Formic Pro. And it turns out they expire in August of this year. So I had so much product that it would just be wrong to waste it. And so I treated those colonies with Formic Pro. I wrecked my entire experiment, I know. But you know what? I'm going to be pragmatic and not let the product go to waste for the principle of that. This stuff's not expensive. Or inexpensive. So my main production colonies got a Formic Pro treatment after being withdrawn from all of that capped brood. I think in the long run, that's actually an interesting idea too, because it's going to make them stronger. If there's any possibility that the Formic Pro didn't penetrate the caps, guess what? These bees are in the same state as what I was trying to put the consolidated one of letting all the bees emerge. And so we'll see how this turns out. It wasn't the plan, I know. I also hustled up to Valley Crest and treated those two hives with Formic Pro. And I'll likely give them an oxalic acid treatment later. So from a local hive report, one of the things I need to do is look into the Lane's hive and see how it's doing. I have to say, with all that I've had going on, and I won't drub through what I've been going through, I haven't been in that hive. I've just left it to its own devices. The last time I looked at it, they were building out to frame 4, 5, 6. And they were doing okay, but it's been a strange year food-wise for them, resources, with no honey coming in for the rest of the hive, so I don't know. It really should be fed, and maybe this week I'll go look and see how it's doing and devise a method for feeding it to make it a little stronger to get through winter. As to the outward appearance, all the colonies look good. I've been through them all, and this is just a public service announcement. This is the time of year where you should go through all of your colonies just to make sure that the queens are doing what they're supposed to, that you have brood in all stages, that your queen didn't run out of gas after laying all season, especially if you have an older queen. I think every queen in my operation, except for the one swarm that I captured, which I have no idea how old the queen is 2 years old. So I would not anticipate seeing a 2.5, 3-year-old failure in my operation. But you might, and you might also want to check your hives, because if your queen goes south this time of year, your hive will dwindle and dwindle and dwindle through August and September under mite pressure. And hopefully you're monitoring and treating by now. My edict is you want to have clean bees by October, and that starts with treatments in July and August. August 8th, you want clean bees so that the four generations of bees, 21 days, 21 days, 21 days, 21 days, takes you to October 31st, and at that point your colony should be in winterization mode. Local hive report, I'm happy with where I'm at. We'll see where the year brings. I'm continuing to feed. I pulled all those feeders out for the main colonies, but I haven't been feeding them yet. I really need to get on the stick with that. One of the things that I'll say that I thought was interesting is one of the colonies found resources somewhere and is starting to pack in nectar. One out of the 12 found some resource. I was surprised. I went to lift the honey boxes off in order to put the Formic Pro on, and the thing was loaded. All the other ones were light as can be. I wanted to get the Formic treatments on, and now I can go take off the honey supers that are excess, the ones that we harvested. These colonies, will never fill 3 boxes of honey supers in the fall nectar flow with what we have around here. Although I have to say, earlier this year, the neighbor came through and mowed the field next to us. That's what, 7-8 acres? Mowed it to the ground. And it's now at least knee high, and I'm hoping somewhere in there, because sometimes this happens, that field blooms with goldenrod or something for the fall. That's physically right next door, which would be spectacular for my bees. All the mint and things in the gardens, the bees are working that, but forage-wise, there's not a lot out there. As it is, fairly typical late summer, heading to fall. It's been in the 90s plus every single day. Tomorrow it's supposed to be a high of 72. And it's supposed to be cool through the week. So who knows? Maybe we're going to get into that shifting pattern. One thing I note when standing in the kitchen at 7 something at night is it's not light like it has been, you know, as the light tapers off and we're starting to move towards darker nights. Yeah, it's starting to feel like fall is right around the corner. Local hive report, check. I think this is a good place to close down the episode. It's later in the evening, and I have to say, we made the chocolate avocado mousse. Oh my, oh yeah. Oh, yeah, That's all I'm going to say about that. We have 2 fairs that our local beekeepers association does. One of them is the Warren County Fair that happened to collide with the Eastern Apiculture Society Conference, but the Hunterdon County one is coming up here in the end of August. Signed up for Friday night, which is the happening night. There's fireworks going on. Sharon and I will be in the booth along with our fellow Northwesters talking about beekeeping, selling honey, doing bee displays. We have an observation hive. We also have a booth where we open a hive and talk about what's inside. Fun times. I want to say this is probably a decade and a half of going and supporting the fairs. If you're part of an association and they have this going on, not for nothing, go to your fair or your local outreach events and spend time with the other beekeepers. It's so much fun to talk to them in the in-between times and learn about beekeeping and what they do and make friends in beekeeping. Some of the people that I love to associate with are ones that I've spent a day with at the fair over these many years and years of volunteering. And Beekeepers Association follow the Pareto principle, which is a certain percentage does all the work. There's so many beekeepers in a beekeepers association. It is such a pleasant and wonderful thing to see a beekeeper come out of the woodwork who we haven't seen for a while show up at the fair and just spend time and be friendly and help, because many hands make light work. So if you're a beekeeper and you haven't done this for a while, sign up when the sign-up sheet comes around for volunteers. Like our beloved bees, when beekeepers go together, we can accomplish great things. Thanks for listening, everybody. Hope you enjoyed the episode, and we'll catch you next time on the Beekeeper's Corner.